asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking atrocious auto pay, the high cost of working from home, and IRS coming for savers.
That's right, buddy. This is our Friday flight, and we're going to discuss the top stories that we came across this week and how it's going to impact your wallet.
And by the way,
or your purse.
The IRS likely isn't going to show
whatever it
home,
is you keep your money
in. But you might get an unexpected tax bill. That's what we'll talk about.
Yeah, we will talk about that later. By the way, did you see that, speaking of tax write-offs, Facebook is no longer going to be they're no longer going to be footing the bill, I guess, for the credit card transactions when you donate to a nonprofit via Facebook.
I did see that.
The platform.
So okay. I have a friend who runs a nonprofit, and because of that perk and because of the fact that her nonprofit accepts donations via Facebook, she reached out to me proactively and was like, hey, just wanted to let you know.
Oh.
I know you love donating via credit card through this way because you get the perks without having to pay the additional 2.9% processing fee or whatever, but that will no longer be the case at the end of this month. So if you're like, I donate through Facebook and I like to use my credit card and get the points or rewards or whatever, maybe meet a spending threshold to get the bonus.
That's what's I've only used it a couple times, but in both cases, it was to do that.
Yep.
It was to hit that spend threshold. It was such an easy way of going about that for spending, in this case, giving, that you're already going to do. So it was a win-win.
And now Zuckerberg, his philanthropic help, he's just not going to do that anymore for us.
Credit card fees, man, they're impacting everybody.
Yeah.
And so I don't fault them necessarily for making adjustments and realizing that, all right, we've got to, just like everybody else out there, whether it's cell phone companies who are offering discounts on plans, or in this case, they're just saying, we're not quite willing to cover the cost of it anymore. But you've got a few more weeks.
Or a couple, I guess. Not much longer. You got to get it in there.
2.5 weeks.
And by the way, we'll talk more about year-end giving before the year is out. But it's time to start thinking about that. And remember that you don't necessarily get a tax write-off for every single donation that you make. But at least in the case of Facebook, for now, for just a couple more weeks, you get to donate with a credit card without getting stuck with the processing fees. But that's going away soon.
That's right, man. Let's dive into it. Let's get to our first story, which is about the EV tax credit. Basically, the good news keeps on rolling for potential EV buyers. Prices, they've been going down significantly, and led in large part by Tesla. They've slashed the prices on most of their models.
I've seen you salivating over the Tesla prices.
Yes, you have. But starting in January, new EV buyers are going to have the ability to get their tax credit in the form of an instant price cut at the dealership. instead of having to wait to get it back on their tax return the following April, which is a long, that's a lot of time, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, if you were looking at potentially doing that sooner than later, you could be waiting like, what, 16 months before you actually saw that credit, before you felt that yourself.
Yeah, you know it's coming, but you're like, hand is out.
Massively delayed response.
Waiting for the long arm of the government to actually stick the money in your hands.
Yeah, lawmakers in D.C. are currently working with dealerships across the country to help them to get up to speed on this process and how it's going to work. But we still want you to know that there are income limits in order to qualify for that tax rebate. But how much nicer is it going to be to not have to, again, just wait around? Because that's because of how large the tax breaks are, the rebate, it has a serious impact on, I think, on a lot of EV buyers' decision to make that purchase.
The value.
It's not like a $200 little bonus, right? It is thousands of dollars.
The value proposition between a $40,000 car and a $32,000 car is massive. It makes a big difference. And so, yeah, this new perk, by the way, it applies to used EVs under $25,000 as well. Those come with a tax break of up to $4,000, which you can only get from a dealership, of course, not from a private sale, because there's all sorts of ways you could hoodwink the government, I guess, if you were doing a private sale trying to get the rebate back. You'd be like, yeah, I bought my brother's EV and sold it back to him, and we both get the discount, right? But yeah, dealerships are essentially going to be reimbursed by the federal government within 72 hours of you making that purchase on a used or new electric vehicle. And don't forget, by the way, that these tax credits are going to be around for years. So even though this change is happening January 1st, there's no rush necessarily to head in on New Year's Day to the dealership and buy that electric vehicle. Well, one, maybe your gas-powered vehicle or your older electric vehicle is doing just fine.
And and it's paid for, yeah, by the way.
Don't let this necessarily drive you to do something crazy. But also, competition in the EV space is increasing on what seems like a daily basis, right? And so there's going to be more and more options, hopefully even more price competition in the space. And you can still get this EV tax credit a few years from now if you want to wait. By the way, one of our favorites, Matt, Rivian, or one of my personal favorites, they're having a tough time reaching profitability. And even though the average Rivian costs $80,000, which is way outside of my budget, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that outlined that every vehicle they make cost them $110,000 or more to actually produce. So,
not great for Rivian.
Not great for Rivian. Yeah, and unlikely still that I'm going to find myself buying one.
But I think what you said is true. Fingers crossed that as we continue to see just advances in technology and prices declining, the ability to snag an EV a couple years down the road. That's what I'm hoping for, mm-hmm, personally. But speaking of cars, the average annual cost of car ownership has skyrocketed. It has gone up more than 13% from last year, up to a $12,000 average, according to AAA.
That's $1,000 a month.
Yeah, that's a lot of money, man. And so, which makes us want to encourage folks to consider, honestly, just walking more, maybe consider biking a bit more than you have previously. And I say that knowing that a lot of folks aren't going to do that. Actually, there is an article in Bloomberg this week which found that biking to work, unfortunately, it is not gaining any momentum. It's not gaining any steam, which means that we've kind of failed in our mission to get more folks to bike more often. Folks are commuting via bike less often than they were 10 years ago, which is, honestly, it's tough to stomach. It's sad to see that this is the direction that we're going.
I felt kind of like a knife through my gut when I saw that.
Yes, because we want folks to consider how much money they could actually save. And according to the latest data, they'd be able to save more than we've ever seen before.
The stakes are higher, right?
As
the average annual cost of car ownership goes through the roof, and then you're talking about $1,000 a month. Well, every mile that you don't drive, you're putting money back in your pocket. And that's even more true, by the way, if you drive a truck. And so it might be time to consider ditching one if you don't necessarily need it, right? Some people drive a truck just because it's like, I like the truck, right? I like the bed in the back and
the utility to be able to potentially.
But are you using it?
Yeah.
Right? And so when you look
at the
numbers
from the store,
you're going to pay over $1 a mile to run one of those bigger, beefier trucks, and closer to 60 cents a mile driving a compact SUV. The type of car that you drive matters. And so does driving an older car, right? Because you take so much less of a depreciation hit. The older the car that you drive, it means there's just less value to be lost, which is helpful to your overall personal finance situation. But driving less does too, right? Right. So back to your point, Matt, walking and biking more is going to make a difference in keeping that car off the road, keeping your car in better shape, fewer repairs, less gas, all that kind of stuff too. And so, yeah, maybe we'll try again in the style of Don Quixote to push How to Money listeners to dust off their bikes and hit the streets. Because, and I realize if you
live... It's a great time of year to do it, by the way.
It is.
It's perfect weather out there. You and I, literally this morning, we rode back from dropping the little dudes off at daycare. So freaking nice out there.
Couldn't be better. This fall is...
It's the best.
Prime bike riding season. And I get if you live like 40 miles away from your job, right? That's a big ask. But could you at least... just hop on to get your groceries, like, because every little bit matters. And I think we've talked about this before, something like 50% of our car trips are 4 miles or less. And if we could hop on the bike for
very bikeable distances,
even just for those, that would make a big difference. And guess what? We'd be healthier too. Yes. We'd be getting that fresh air. We'd see our neighbors.
That's the other part of it too. It's not that you're just reaping the financial rewards. You are going to be healthier as well, even if you opt for an e-bike, because guess what? You're still going to be moving your body a lot more on an e-bike than you would just sitting in your car as you commute to work. A friend of ours, Garrett, he reached out and was just like, hey, dudes, I think he did this a year ago, but we don't see him. So I think it was out of sight, out of mind. But he texted us and was like, after listening to a bunch of How to Money, I sold my car and I bought an e-bike instead. And he bikes to work every single day now.
So some people are doing it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Some folks are doing it. We shouldn't be too down on ourselves, but we obviously want to see that trend continue. And there's just... Dude, there's something else that you gain. So, yes, you're going to be healthier. Yes, it'll save you money. But you just develop a sense of grit, right? Like, you realize that you are more capable of doing things, not just biking, but beyond that. I feel like it has this ability to spread into other areas of your life where you realize, oh, man, I am capable of so much more than you would typically give yourself credit
for. Things you
thought
were hard before become just a little bit easier because you're like, I
figured this out. I can figure this out.
7 miles to work in the cold or whatever. And so I can handle this or that too.
100%.
Yeah. All right. Well, how you get to work matters less than whether or not you show up, by the way. So you got to show up to work. That's important to keep that paycheck coming. And by showing up, by the way, I mean going back into the office. And we've seen lots of companies pushing for this mass migration back. They want all their workers to come back in. They're kind of forcing their employees to come back in at least 3 out of 5 days. And some are saying even more than that. But a new survey shows that even if your employer isn't necessarily forcing the issue, making you come back in, you might want to consider heading back to the cubicle life voluntarily. Why? Well, because you're far more likely to get a raise or a promotion. And so a survey of CEOs found that 9 in 10 say they're going to give more pay, better positions, and superior assignments to folks who are in the office regularly. And this is like...
That's incredible data.
Yeah.
90%. All odds point to you getting paid more were you to show up.
It's not shocking to me. It doesn't surprise me
it makes sense.
CEOs and that managers and stuff say, hey, if you're in the office more, you're likely going to benefit financially and career-wise. So I see this data and I'm like, makes sense to me, but I also get the reluctance because work from home is so alluring.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so hybrid work, right? So the ability to work from home some of the week, but at least going into the office, let's say 3 out of 5 days, right? Like, it doesn't have to be like a cold turkey on or off switch, but especially for How to Money listeners who are earlier in their career, I think it could pay even more because as you are slowly kind of climbing that ladder, you're learning how things work. It could make a whole lot of sense to make sure that you're there at least 3, if not, I don't know, maybe 4. Consider going in 5 days a week occasionally.
Yeah. I mean, I think those benefits can accrue to people of all ages and in a whole bunch of different, you know, fields of work. But I think you're right. The biggest benefits go to people who are earlier on in their career.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the biggest downside of going into work are those additional costs. And we just talked about commuting. But a study finds that the average employee spends $51 a day in order to simply go into the office. And not surprisingly, they highlight commuting and food costs are the biggest culprits. And so we've already talked about the commuting aspect and how maybe you could sort of mitigate those expenses by biking, perhaps maybe even taking public transit. But let's talk about the...
Or carpooling.
Or carpooling. Yeah. Highly underrated.
One of your coworkers lives close to where you work. Like, hop in the car together. That feels like so old school and antiquated, but I'm telling you, it works. Like,
yeah.
It's a great way to save money.
But let's talk about the food costs portion of of what they found, because this is something that's near and dear to my heart. That's right. We're going to talk about leftovers.
Okay, Dad.
For a second. When 40% of our grocery bill literally ends up in the trash because it's food that we don't actually eat, this is an area that's ripe for us to be able to cut back on, mm-hmm. on our expenses. And like, it is a, it's a, it's a lose-lose situation when we don't eat that food, because what happens, yes, we are not consuming the groceries we've already purchased, but then on top of that, what are we then doing instead, in particular when we're going in to the office because we don't have lunch? Well, then you go out to eat, and that, which is perhaps the most expensive way that you can feed yourself.
Yeah.
And
leftovers can be great.
I'm proud to say that you and I are, I feel like you've kind of gotten more on the leftover train.
I have.
Dude, I open that fridge and I see your little Tupperware container in there with a couple with a couple eggs, and I think that's a man after my own heart right there. Fry up a couple eggs, put that over some leftovers that you want to heat up.
Yeah.
You got to make sure you get enough protein.
Well, my lunch today is literally steak and eggs. It was protein heavy. So
I had chicken pozole.
Gotta eat some veggies for dinner tonight. But but yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. Those are the costs that, some of those are hard costs. They're impossible to avoid. Other costs are more flexible, and especially when you're talking about the trade-offs of being able to advance in your career, make more money, it might be worth spending the dollars, the gas, the added miles to your car to get into the office to make sure that you're showing your face and you're doing good work, and
absolutely,
your bosses know that you exist. But here's the other thing, the other side of work from home, and I read about this on Tyler Cowen's blog this week, Marginal Revolution. He talks about how work from home tends to make people more productive. And so in some ways, like, I get the call to work from home. One, you can do it in your PJs, you can do laundry at the same time, but also you might actually be getting more done. But here's the thing, when you dig into the data, the productivity boosts of working from home, they come largely from working more hours, lengthening the workday by almost something like 10%. And so, hey, are you more productive? Yeah, but if you're spending more time on the computer...
Or is it because you're actually just working longer?
Yeah.
Which is what seems to be the case, as opposed to you being able to work at a higher level within the same amount of time, right?
So I feel like there's like a jumble.
I actually kind of feel the opposite, as far as the ability to focus and to more efficiently get work done
in an
office setting.
Well, that's because you're not working in an office environment where there's 50 coworkers and, you know, because it's
totally
just the
true.
Two of us. And so yep. We can be really focused. But I think in those
we
bigger...
We don't have a massive open floor plan,
right,
where folks are just dropping by, wanting to have a quick chat, when I would say, oh, actually, in that case, you should email me.
Right. Yeah, I think that's the biggest downer to working in the office, is you do feel like you're not able to get as much done. And that is because more of your time is sucked up via the commute and via coworkers dropping by. And some of that's
true.
Healthy, right? Like seeing the people you work with and having those spontaneous interactions.
Last week a little bit, just the socialization and the connection to other people.
Yeah.
You can't discount that.
It's just like a jumble of data here. And so there is no holistic prescription. It is very much individual to your own situation. But take all these things into account when you're kind of trying to figure out, where do I want to work? How much am I going to work from home? Should I go into the office more? And even if, let's say, your employer allows you to work from home as much as you want, maybe showing your face at least a couple times a week could be to your benefit. But I don't know. You got to think about all the stuff. And I get that long commutes are a pain in the butt, and you might actually be getting more done at home. But hopefully you're still keeping your hours.
Yeah. Maybe instead we can use that time saved that was previously spent commuting towards more beneficial or other related areas. Not related, but just other areas that are also important, like your physical health, relationships, things like that,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just working more.
Yeah.
But all right, we've got more stories that we're going to get to. We will actually share our thoughts on whether or not we've changed our opinion on financial advisors, right? With the interest rates being where they are they still necessary or as not necessary, as we've previously said? We'll get to that story plus several others right after this.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
And now a word from the show sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
All right, we're back. As always, it's time for the ludicrous headline of the week at this point in the Friday flight. And this article comes from the Wall Street Journal. And the headline reads, AutoPay is making us worse at managing credit card bills. And Matt, you and I, we talk about automating your finances pretty regularly on the show.
It seems counterintuitive.
So this one caught my attention. And I was like, what are you guys up to, you tricksters at the Journal? But the truth is, it's mostly a good thing to have bills paid on repeat, right? Without having to log in or remember to make those payments every month. Makes me think of, not to throw you under the bus, but you forgot to pay our rent this month.
I did.
And our landlord was like, hey, dude, it's the 9th. Are you guys going to pay rent? Did you pay it? It was a few days ago.
It totally slipped my mind, which I felt terrible about. And by the way, I set up our, so I always pay via Zelle. And I didn't know this, but you can set up recurring payments via Zelle.
There you go.
And so, guess what?
You're back on the automatic payment train.
Yeah, he's going to be getting paid on the first of every month for our little office here. But yeah, even though he's a friend, I don't want to...
Take advantage of that.
I don't want him to be in the position to where he has to come knocking. Right. And he's like, hey guys.
Well, he knows. It's like once. We pay on time. Yeah, right? Most of that. Yeah. But
thanks for the grace.
You're right. But a new study finds that folks end up underpaying when they auto pay. How does this happen? Well, the crux of the problem is that people are not signing up for the full statement balance option when they set up that auto pay, right? And so a good chunk of folks are choosing to auto pay the minimum balance, and then they never go back and change it, which obviously means they're racking up a whole lot of interest because they're not paying off that balance on time and in full, which is pretty much the number one rule of credit card usage. And so, Matt, you know, we love auto pay, but the truth is, make sure you're signed up to pay that balance on time and in full.
Full.
Every single month. Yep. So if you're going to do auto pay, and then also make sure that you've got the necessary funds at your bank too, so you're not getting an auto draft fee by having insufficient funds when that credit card bill is supposed to be paid. So both those things are really important. But I guess I never really thought about how this could come back to bite people. Setting it up on auto pay, but only paying a fraction of what you owe.
Well, it optimizes things when it comes to convenience and ensuring that you don't forget to pay anything. But I feel like a downside of autopay is that a lot of folks just don't look very hard at their actual spending because that bill, it just gets paid like clockwork, right? They don't notice that they maybe perhaps spent a little more that month, or maybe they ran the AC a lot more than they had previously.
Which is why I hate budget billing,
yes,
right? Because budget billing is totally set up to get you to not really care about how much energy you're using. It's all about...
It insulates you from your behavior and your usage.
And you might...
That's what I don't like about
it. After the course of a year, see a slight bump up, right, in that monthly budget billing amount, but you're not actually feeling the pain of the usage kind of closer to the time when you use it.
Yeah. So in this way, I feel that setting up AutoPay or an auto draft or auto Zelle, whatever it is, I think it works great, in particular when you have a set amount, like... Our rent doesn't fluctuate on how often we're here, right? Like, it's the same amount. So that's one that's like 100% a bill that should be on auto pay to where I just don't have to think about it ever again. But when it comes to areas of spending where we have more control over, whether it be because we're consuming more or because we're consuming, yeah, more utilities, whether it's gas, water, or electricity, this is a way that we could potentially be spending more money than we otherwise would. It's important to track your spending. It's important to look those bills in the face, even if you are signed up to have that bill automatically paid on or before the due date,
yeah,
so that you can be not only informed from a knowledge, like from a like the information standpoint, but just to kind of like feel it in your guts, yeah, like it's where it's visceral.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think you and I, we're still in favor of automating your finances on so many levels. We think, especially when you're talking about investing or when we're paying debt, but you got to do it the right way. And that means paying the full bill, not just a fraction of it. And that means also, like you said, Matt, being aware of what you're spending, looking at it every single month so that it's not completely in the background and yeah, that you're not oblivious to what's going on with your finances.
Totally.
There's an upside, but there's a potential downside at the same time,
mm-hmm,
that you want to avoid. All right, let's talk about Christmas shopping. And there's new holiday shopping data out. These are predictions about what's going to likely happen with holiday spending this coming year in the next couple of months. And it looks like folks are planning on ramping up Christmas spending in a big way this year, right? Gen Z and millennials are planning to increase their spending the most by something like 14 to 15%, which sounds like a lot.
It does.
Why the big jump? And there's nothing wrong with buying gifts for the people that you love. And inflation, of course, means that those gifts are likely to cost more this year than they did last year. But our advice to you is to start preparing now. If you haven't already, the best time to plant a tree was like a long time ago. But the second best time is now. And so the way you avoid credit card debt is to be proactive. Come up with a list of folks you are planning on buying something for and a budget associated with each one of those folks as well. And then be funneling extra cash into savings now so that you aren't left in the lurch or that you're not swiping the card that you can't actually pay off in full come January.
That's right. Yeah. Every single year, right after Christmas, we do hear from listeners and they've kind of gone overboard when it comes to how much they spend. They regret it. And we want to basically kind of give you some permission to spend less. It is okay to have a conversation with family members about budgets, about expectations.
Makes me think of our minimalist Christmas episode with Meg Norman a couple
years.
Yeah. We should link to that in the show notes.
We should. Yeah, that's a good one to start thinking about now because, you know, we don't want you to go into credit card debt. Pretty much any type of spending and consumption, we don't want you paying interest on that. But we also want you to be careful using buy now, pay later as well. There's a new New York Fed research that found that buy now, pay later users are what they call financially fragile. And it's not even because they don't make enough money, because many folks are actually well off, but they're still living on the financial precipice.
Yeah, it's not a lack of income. And it's like, oh, I have to use buy now, pay later because I can't necessarily afford to pay for the item in full. It's that people have become addicted to these services.
Yeah, their spending continues to keep up with how much they're earning. Mm-hmm. And they never get to a point to where there's actually margin in their lives and they're able to sock away a little bit more. But our biggest problem, too, with buy now, pay later is just the behavioral reaction that it creates. Because when you disassociate the act of getting the item from paying for it, like buy now pay later does, it just leads to a payment buyer mindset. Is this something that in the moment or maybe tomorrow, next month, will I be able to make that payment? I think so. Mm-hmm. Let's go for it.
Yeah.
Our best advice is just avoid this completely. Avoid buy now, pay later for holiday spending. And honestly, really, like at all other times as well, not just now during the holidays.
Yeah, and not that there's so many brilliant, awesome people in Gen Z. I'm not trying to throw them under the bus, but I was talking to someone who's quite a bit younger than me recently, and she was like, yeah, it just makes it easier to buy those nicer jeans when I spread out the payments. I'm like, that's the point. That's what they're trying to get you to do. And the thing is, feeling the pain is actually a good thing. And so if you can't truly afford the item and take the painful step of buying it in one fell swoop, then you should avoid it and wait and save up until you have the money to sock down. But I think because it makes it feel emotionally easier,
yep,
and financially less onerous to buy via buy now, pay later. That's why they become so popular.
Yeah. Buy now, pay later is like budget billing,
yeah,
for your pants.
And yeah, right. And they're creating these bad habits that people are you know, getting into. And it turns into a terrible cycle where people do more and more buy now, pay later because it's so easy and it's so swell. And then they realize, wait a second, I've taken on way too many payments and now my savings have become depleted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of savings, savers, Matt, are mostly satisfied these days. It's been a really tough slog for many, many years, at least a decade, for anybody trying to save money because rates were in the toilet. And so saving money, it kind of felt like repeatedly getting punched in the gut, even though you had savings on hand because you had to, because personal finance, right? You have to have emergency fund. You have to have 3 to 6 months of savings in hand, liquid, And then even as savings rates were going up, well, inflation was going up faster. And so real returns were still negative. And so it was like, woohoo, savings are going up. Oh, crap. Inflation is still ruining any attempt on making it saving more. That's not the case anymore, though. People who have more money in saving now, who don't do business with the big banks, by the way, because that's important to mention. Those big banks pay almost nothing on your savings. They're making real money on their cash. And so that is good news. But I think it's also important to mention that if you have a long enough time horizon, we still don't want you to be too cash heavy. Because like we talked about with Paul Merriman on Wednesday, we're talking millions here. Mm-hmm. And so the money that you're able to stock in the market, yes, your savings account can earn you 5%+ guaranteed, which is great. But the market over the long term is still going to provide higher returns. So don't bank too heavy on cash, even though, woo, that's a bright side. And then one downer, let me say that. These higher interest rates on savings, which equal bigger returns, which means, yeah, you're actually going to get paid real money on that money, are going to mean higher taxes. So watch out for the 1099 INT that you're going to get early next year, especially people who have like, you know, big five figures, or they're getting to six figures in savings. Mm. They're gonna be shocked, I think, to see the 1099 INT. And they're going to be like, I didn't realize I owed this much in tax just that's because right. I got higher returns.
Think of it almost though as like a success tax, right? Like this isn't necessarily something you should be mad about, but you should be prepared for a potentially higher tax bill if you've got a significant chunk of change within your high yield savings account. One other impact of the higher savings rate environment that we're in, this is at least according to Bloomberg, is that these higher guaranteed returns are making financial advisors less attractive, which doesn't make a ton of sense in my book. Again, like you're talking about with Paul Merriman, you need to be investing your money. And when I see headlines like this, it makes me realize that folks have too short-term of a view or take on their finances. Because if something like the interest rate...
I can earn 5%, I don't need you anymore.
No, exactly. As opposed to, like, there are legitimate reasons to consider a financial advisor. Like, oftentimes it's going to come with, like, a major life change, like if you're going to have a kid or if you're getting closer to retirement. Those are good reasons to consider a financial advisor. Mm-hmm. Not, oh, interest rates, oh, it's better than ever before. That means maybe I shouldn't consider investing that money. When, in fact, no, you do need to be investing that money. Personally, if I've got a financial goal that's beyond, right, like 3 to 5 years, I feel very comfortable investing that money. And that's because of the 3 or rolling 5 year returns. The chances are the percentage that the market is actually going to go up is very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
It's not guaranteed, but it's a much higher chance than it going down. So something to consider if you have some of those longer, I don't call them longer term savings goals, but like a medium term savings goal, something beyond 3 to 5 years, you should likely be investing that money, not socking it away into your high yield savings account.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd actually agree on 3 years. I think a 3 year timeline is like real shady about what you should do. 5 years for sure. I think you can be more of have an investor mindset.
Yeah.
3 years you're trying to protect some of that capital, and with higher savings rates, I might be inclined to lean more in that direction, or at least half and
half.
So
historically, I think if every 3 year rolling period, I think it's something like 84% of the time the market goes up. And at 5 years, it only goes up to something like 88%.
Yeah.
So it's actually But beyond 5 years, of course, like the more years you have in order to see that money grow, it's the chances of it going up are higher and higher.
You got to take all that into consideration.
Exactly.
And I think
100%.
Going back to what you said about advisors, it makes me think of something that Paul said on Wednesday. And he said something, if you're willing to take the 50 to 100 hours it takes, and he said that's about how much time it takes to feel like you have the information and the confidence to actually go out there and go the DIY investing route, then you might not need a financial advisor to at least help you with the investing side of things, right?
Sure.
It can ensure that you have the information and you're taking the proper steps to invest your money thoughtfully, reducing fees, putting it in the right funds. You've got the long-term mindset. Mm-hmm. And I think he's right. I think it probably is somewhere in that 50 to 100 hours. And if you do that due diligence, then, and you know what? You probably need to do some of that due diligence anyway to know the right questions to ask a financial advisor that you might hire.
Yeah, you got to be well informed before you even start to have that conversation with a fee-only fiduciary advisor, which is what we would recommend if you want to see an advisor.
It's the exact same thing you and I talk about when it comes to real estate. And if you're going to hire a property manager, well, guess what? You probably should have done it yourself for a year at least anyway, so that you have an idea of what the job entails, so that you know the right questions to ask when you're hiring them. And it's the same thing when you're talking about a financial advisor. It's like, You're more likely to get hoodwinked if you have no idea what questions to ask. You might end up with a financial advisor who has, you know, different sorts of incentives that aren't aligned with yours.
That's right. But that being said, everybody's different and everyone has different needs as to what they're looking for when it comes to investing and the kind of, you know, the different kinds of assistance that you need. So we'll link to XY Planning Network, as well as NAPFA, which is the National Association of Personal Finance Advisors.
Yeah.
Both of those have a nice network of fee-only fiduciary advisors.
Yeah, a lot of those incentives
can set you straight.
Are aligned before you even pick the exact one because of the website and
exactly.
The vetting they do on the front end to ensure that these are advisors who are going to, who are fiduciary fee-only advisors who are going to do and help you in a way that doesn't screw you over.
So. It's a bunch of folks who are in good company
with
each other. But that's going to be it for this Friday flight. We hope everyone out there has a great weekend, and we will make sure to link to some of the different resources that we mentioned during this episode up in the show notes at howtomoney.com. So that's it, bud. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves, so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.